It's Wednesday, June 12th, 2013, and you're listening to episode 302 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 39 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
This is Johan.
This is Wayne.
And this is Chris.
So, Chris, I have a question. I'm curious how you perceive time. Is it kind of like Pac-Man, where you just go off one side and come back on the other?
In a lot of ways, yeah, because so many things seem to cycle around, you know, over and over and over again that, yeah, you do kind of feel like you're running through that little bit of maze. And when you go through one end, then you'll come back out the other. So, yeah, absolutely.
I always figured it was more like at the end of Army of Darkness, the ending where he sleeps too long. I always kind of envision, like, he sees things change and change and change. But, you know, once he comes out, he just has a really long beard and he needs a, you know, needs a shower.
There's an alternate ending where he just slept too long.
Yeah, there's an alternate ending where they give him a potion instead and he took too many drops. And he sleeps into the apocalypse.
Do you know what that's from? That's classic fiction. That's the Connecticut Yankee and King Arthur's court. That's how Merlin gets rid of the Connecticut Yankee, is by giving him a potion, which is actually kind of funny because one of the interesting things about that particular book is throughout most of it, they really give you the sense that there's no such thing as magic.
Yeah.
That Merlin is basically just a charlatan and a huckster. And what happens is the Connecticut Yankee comes along and he actually has some sense of science and technology and industry and is able to create things that do what Merlin claims he can do. And it's not magic, but he's just doing it through technology and innovation. But then at the very, very end of the book, Mark Twain kind of reverses that out because Merlin then uses actual magic to get rid of him.
I find that book entirely ridiculous anyway, because as we all know, science, innovation, technology, these are all things that don't exist in Connecticut and never did.
So. You know, it's kind of funny, though, to read that book, because to borrow a phrase from C.S. Lewis, there's a certain amount of chronological snobbery. You can kind of sense that Mark Twain, living in the era that he did, was thumbing his nose at the, you know, foolish and stupid people of the Middle Ages. And yet, sitting here in the 21st century reading his book, I find myself feeling the exact same way about his characters and their innovations and their level of technology and industry and their grasp of science and whatnot. So it's kind of this, I don't know.
So Merlin didn't use .NET, is what you're saying?
Yeah, exactly.
Pascal all the way.
Yeah, precisely. You know, I just couldn't agree with any. He was using a heavyweight waterfall and all. I just couldn't agree with anything the man was doing. So anyway, all right, that's not what this show is about. So this show, actually, all jokes aside, really, this actually does kind of tie together. Wayne, great transition. It's about resurrection. It's about waking things up, moving things around, bringing them back. And there's two angles.
Which is why we have Chris on this episode.
Did somebody wake him up?
No, I'm here to bring the sexy back. That's why I'm here.
It's well saying Chris ran out of time, which is kind of like death. And he just came back on the other side of the play field. So
it respawned, basically.
Yeah, it's like watching The Curious Case of Benjamin Button backwards on loop. So,
ouch.
How unlucky do you get to have Iowa as a spawn point?
All right. So, Chris, let's start off with you have resurrected a game.
I did.
Talk.
The campaign that I've been running throughout 2012, throughout 2011, that's been basically the dominating thing that we've been doing as a group.
See, he even did his years backwards.
Well, no, I'm going backwards.
I'm telling you.
So, anyway, what ended up happening is in the round October, November or so, you know, the holidays began to get in the way. Other things started to get in the way as well that, you know, as often happens, and we've talked about it here, this stuff gets in the way of your gaming time. This problem persisted for a number of months, and some of it was self-generated as well. When we actually had the time to get together as a group, I had not taken the time to properly prep the game. And yeah, I could have sat down, I could have winged it, but the problem was is that we're very near the end of the campaign. So we're near, you know, the end of Act 3, essentially. So the problem developed where we finally now, just within the past month, came around to a time when we could actually sit down, we could actually kind of get back into the campaign, but I realized that we'd been gone for, you know, quite some time. And while that would not have been an issue for me, considering, you know, any other time along that timeline of the campaign, the fact that we were basically right at the end, we were about to enter the big climactic battle, I didn't want to sit back down after 7 months of not doing this campaign and then jump right back in with players who aren't familiar with A, their characters' personalities, B, their abilities, and then have me be, you know, end up essentially doing a TPK when it really wouldn't have been a justifiable TPK in this particular situation.
All TPKs are justifiable, Chris.
This one wouldn't have been. It would have been unfair to those guys. So I emailed them and I said, okay, here we go, guys. We actually have the chance to do this. I want to do this, but I'm concerned about this situation, and I don't think it's fair to do it to any of us, really, to do it this way. And I was concerned on my end, my own selfish aspects, of losing that dramatic impact that you could have as you approach that big finale. So I suggested to them, so why don't we, so we can kind of slip back into the mood and the mode of the campaign and the feel, why don't we do something with some pre-generated characters that would be on essentially a parallel course with what is the main characters are doing in the campaign. So it would kind of affect the storyline, but it would have been like a sub-chapter that probably would have gotten cut from the final book.
A little easy listening, a little role-playing other characters.
Exactly.
Light some candles.
Yeah, exactly.
Pour a little bit of champagne in the hot tub.
Yeah. All right. And we all pretend we're in Vegas. But what ended up happening is one of my players suggested, he said, no, you know what, why don't we use our main characters, but why don't we do it as, why don't we treat it as like a side trek kind of thing, something that you might see on, you know, an episode of Star Trek, which is out of the continuity of the plot, of the overarching plot, but the characters did this at some point. I said, yeah, okay, let's give it a shot. What I ended up doing was I came up with a scenario. I put a general time and place of when this probably happened, but did not make them, like, backdate their characters' abilities and stuff. I said, just go with what you've got. You're recalling the story, so you remember. You never really remember things exactly as how they happened. So the abilities they had, well, they had them, even though they didn't probably didn't really have them at that time. To my surprise, overall, it really came out well. By the end of the session, they were really playing their characters closer personality-wise to what I remember them being. There was a few slip-ups here and there where they probably did things that they would not have normally done. But all that was really kind of, we all kind of excused and just hand-waved that away because we all really knew what was going on.
Within every group I have ever been a part of, and I know I'm not alone in this because we're talking to other people, while mileage seems to vary a little bit from group to group, I've certainly talked to plenty of other people who've had this same situation. If you've got a weekly game going and you miss 1 week, not a big deal. Second week, it may take a little bit to kind of remember where you were at in the plot, especially if it's a complex plot, but nonetheless, you'll be okay. But after that, there is a pretty sharp curve. By the second week off, you've got maybe a 50% chance of salvaging that game. By the third week off, you've got maybe like a 10 or 20% chance of salvaging that game. By the fourth week off, forget it. It is dead, gone, and never coming back. And to the best of my recollection, I cannot remember a single campaign that was intended to be an ongoing long campaign. I'm not talking about something where we said, oh, hey, this is kind of something shallow and fun that we'll just use as filler. I've seen those come back after months of break. But I don't think I have ever seen a single campaign where the intention was to run a long campaign from start to finish, and it actually made it through with a long break and then recovered from the break. The closest I can come to that was we did have a BattleTech campaign that went on for several years, and it ended. And after it ended, months if not, I believe it was years passed, and that group got back together. And we said, you know what? Let's play a part two. Let's just go ahead and say the plot has advanced all these years. Kind of like the transition between Ghostbusters 1 and Ghostbusters 2. All these years have passed. The team's kind of fallen apart. And then something happens to draw everyone back together to dust off the mechs and to kind of have to get back into the mix once again as the old crew. But Chris, I am fascinated by the fact that you were able to successfully resurrect a campaign that had been, by my definition, dead. And I'm curious if you could kind of break down into some points. And I know you listed some of them just now, but could you really draw into discrete items here the tactics that you used to make that work? You know, how did you get people back into the characters? How did you get people to remember what was going on in the plot? How did you keep people from chasing the new shiny instead?
there was the threat of the new Shiny for quite some time throughout that time period where I was saying, oh, yeah, yeah, we should be able to finish soon, you know, as we're about into the fourth month of delay. We were already working on the new Shiny. You know, all four of us had kind of gotten sucked up into that. But when we sat down at the table to actually get started, the amount of time it took for us from the moment we sat down to the moment we actually like said, okay, let's start gaming, was much longer. And that time was spent, we all just kind of collectively were recalling bits and pieces of what had happened and where the plot actually did leave off and these various actions and things that had taken, these NPCs we had encountered and the relationship that we had with them and this person here, that person there. So we spent more time in recollection mode to kind of draw up a lot of those memories, because all four of us were very invested in the campaign. You know, the players were very invested in their characters. I was very invested in the plot. And so we took that extra time just to go through that recollection phase. And then once that had just kind of naturally run its course, I made sure on the GM side of things, I kind of introduced roughly when this was, which helped to trigger a few more memories. You know, I said, okay, do you guys remember the time when you were in this particular village and you went in this particular cave setting? And they're like, oh yeah, everybody remembered that. I said, this is around when that time is going to occur.
What also sounds like you used something of a metagame trick, because it was likened, I believe, to a Star Trek episode that's kind of out of continuity, that you intentionally said, look, this game's out of continuity. This is, I don't know how you spun it exactly, but you could spin it as saying, this is how the bards tell the story after it happened. And, you know, I think what that does is that gives the players a sense of liberty where you can say, it doesn't have to be exactly right. If I'm not 100% in character, if I don't remember everything that occurred, if I recollect an event wrong or say something I wouldn't have otherwise said, that's just how they screwed up the story in the retelling. And it seems like that gives you a metagame sense of freedom to, I don't know, reapproach the game a little bit less literally.
It did, actually.
Well, I think he really kind of covered, we don't have to worry too much about maintaining continuity part when he said he likened it to a Star Trek episode.
You're right in your assessment, Dan, because even within the email chain, as we were, you know, leading up to that Sunday, one of my players kind of wrote it out saying, you know, we're going to end up recalling this as a tale as we sit around the fireside saying, do you remember that time when? And that ended up kind of becoming like a running gag throughout that particular session this past Sunday when each person said, yeah, but I would be telling the story, so this is actually probably really how it happened. Or you were actually telling this part of the story, so that's probably how you would say it happened. When a character would do something, either got a bad dice roll or there was a particular NPC interaction that was out of place, we just attributed that to, well, that's how he told the story.
Chris, I think you hit on something else there, though, that you didn't mention. There was an email conversation about the game leading up to it. If it's actually about the game and the session you're going into, that can really do a lot to get buy-in. Get people thinking about it during the week before they actually sit down at the table.
Yeah, well, we had built up the fact that, yes, it was going to happen this Sunday. Yes, we were going to do it. Yes, it was going to indeed actually finally flip and be the campaign after all of these delays. And I think because of the fact that we all had enjoyed it up to the end point where it did, you know, get stuck on the vine, there was anticipation of being able to personalize it, to see this person again, you know, that you hadn't seen in a long time. And so you have this anticipation. So for me anyway, it got me internally excited to sit down. I also made me nervous as hell because, A, I felt a lot of personal responsibility for how the campaign had kind of withered. Then I had to I felt like I had to perform again in a certain sense. So that was actually, you know, beneficial in a certain way as well, because one of the things that I also did when we finally did engage in the gaming, I went into some of my old modes, you know, where I had certain ways in which I described things and certain level of detail that I would attach to certain things. And I jumped into that mode so they were familiar with that particular approach. And they could latch onto those details.
So what happened from there? So you kind of take this lighthearted, almost metagame approach to reintroducing the campaign. What happens from there? Do you keep it that way? Do you say, okay, now that you guys are kind of back in the groove of things, let's move from the metagame to the more proper telling of the story and get back into the real characters and the real events? What do you do with it from there?
For me, that's kind of what my plan is going to be. You know, the plan is we're going to sit down again this Sunday and we're going to game, and I have to go back over my notes, but I'm mentally ready to get back into that. And, you know, judging by their post session reactions to everything, they seem to be also kind of in that mode as well. And, you know, I'm going to be a bit more cognizant too of the fact that I could tell that some of their character abilities they weren't completely familiar with, because there were some, you know, poor decisions made during one of the combat encounters that would not have been made when we were in full campaign mode. So, you know, I'll be a bit more cognizant of that, but yeah, we'll go in there, and I might take some time to do a little bit more of a lengthier, you know, previously on type of introduction to really help get everybody back into this is what was going on, this is where you were going to do, to kind of build up some of that tension a little bit more as we move into that, you know, those last few sessions.
So, Chris, I'm really curious, does this group interact outside of gaming, or is that their only interaction? Because one thing I've seen as this death knell, what initially starts it, is the groups missed 1 week, 2 week, 3 weeks. The first thing you get is everybody catching up and socializing. Then you go into the catching up on what we did last in the game. And then you actually start the game after half of your gaming time is spent just getting up to speed. The first game back ends up being a little lackluster, and that starts the spiral down.
As a group, actually, only two of them out of the four of us actually socialize more frequently. Primary time that we interact with them is on those gaming days. Now, one of the guys, Brent, he has done some other things on the side with them. My schedule has never really allowed me to do a lot of that. So if out of any of the group, the person that probably socializes the least with them is actually probably me. But the nice part is when we're sitting around the table and everything, we all, as just four individuals, get along very well. So we do certainly do some socializing and some catching up and talking about, oh, you know, did you hear Microsoft and the Xbox One? Blah, blah, blah. And then we kind of do that a little bit. And then there's that surface level of conversation that's normal. And then we follow the exact pattern that you laid out there, Wayne. In the end lesson here for me was I felt, you know, on a personal level, a little bit of redemption. Because, like I said, I felt some definite guilt over part of this happening, because this had not ever happened really to me before. And so there was a lot of personal responsibility.
Sure,
I felt.
We all say that.
Yeah, I swear to God, this has never happened
time,
before.
It's the first time.
I never thought it would happen to me.
Actually, that's why after seeing this happen so many times, I aim for the story arcs. I don't even try for the long run. I try to get it nice, short, burst.
We can get through that. We've all heard about that.
Yeah.
I mean, we're aware.
Taking out all of our innuendo. I will never stop trying for the long run, because to me, those are the campaigns that are in my head. Those are the stories that I tell best.
Yeah.
I've said many times over, and I still believe that I do not shine as a GM in the short run. I do not believe my con games are half as good as my ongoing campaigns.
I've never even tried the long run, just because I've seen so many campaigns fail.
Yeah.
And I get frustrated because there's that lack of completion.
Well, yeah. And you know what? Let me just call a spade here and kind of dissect what I think is part of the problem, Wayne, within the gaming groups that I have historically been a part of, at least within recent years. I don't think this was true going way back, but within recent years, you know, we look at gaming as a hobby, which we should. Okay. I'm not saying that's wrong. But the fact is that every hobby requires a certain level of dedication and work. If you want to play a musical instrument and you have no interest in practicing it and no interest in actually, you know, reading through the books and whatnot that teach you how to play it and no interest in going to the lessons, then you're never going to be able to play that one song. You know, if you sat down learning piano because you wanted to play Chopin, you're never going to get there. And I think the same thing is true of gaming, in that we approach our games, I think, too casually. And I don't think we should take them like, oh, gaming, serious business. I think that's an insane extreme.
No, Blackleaf!
But we've gone kind of that opposite extreme where I really don't think we put in much effort at all to making the hobby work, which is why our campaigns die so frequently and so easily. Obviously,
that's
not
because we're real live grown-ups now. Is the sad thing.
Well, I think that's some of it, but I don't think that says all of it, because, for example, I was not on episode 301, but while I was editing it, I was listening to Bastard stutter and stumble and have to clean that up. You know, but the point being,
yay, it's not
while
just
I'm editing
me.
That episode, no, it's not just you, Chris. But the point is, while I'm editing that episode, you know, I'm listening to you guys tell these stories about how you guys were having conversations outside of the game. And Dawn went and drew pencil maps of Lomar Sculpture Park and all this stuff. And there was a level of effort in there. You know, once again, some people would say, wow, so that's kind of too dorky or too far. But I don't care. The point being, there was a level of effort put into the game.
By everyone.
Yes. Yeah,
by everyone to keep that alive. And that's something that I think, once again, my more recent gaming groups have not done, which is one of the contributing factors to our games dying so easily.
You know, that's a good point. When I look at Knights of Rainsboro, the actual play I do with Funny Books guys, we put a lot into it. So even though we went without a game for 6 months or so, it was also seasonal as well. We were writing fiction. We were doing other things.
Yeah, precisely.
And it never left our mind. I think that's one big thing, is that with Chris's email conversation, I think that helps.
Yeah.
Out of sight, out of mind. So if you keep talking about it, you're more likely to come back to it.
And, you know, even when I was actively gaming on a regular basis, most of our games were monthly, not weekly, sometimes twice a month. And you really have to have that sort of involvement when you have spaced out sessions. So, I mean, a lot of the things that you guys have been talking about as far as coming back to a game that's been abandoned, this is all just how you game in my mind. And this is just, it's a normal event. This is...
Well, along those lines, do you know what most recently actually kind of started the wheels turning in my head about resurrecting a long dead campaign? Was telling stories about Gnarl on the air. Sitting here recollecting those stories about Gnarl kind of gave me that urge to play him again and to see where that story would go. It was, once again, putting some outside effort into that hobby.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's kind of crazy on our part that we treat role-playing as if, unlike any other hobby, it will just happen without any kind of dedication or effort.
That's actually how I treat all my hobbies, just to clarify. I have so many like instruments that I never actually bothered to learn to play,
and
exercise equipment I don't use, and you name it, I've got it.
I would have all that, but my wife took it all and sold it on Craigslist
because
I was never going to use it.
Five gaming consoles that I never play.
I'm with you, though, Dan. I am all about the long view, and I think that, you know, in certain ways is a plus for me, and in other ways it's a detriment, actually. But I think one vision I've had in my head for how one aspect of this campaign will end, I've had since when it damn near started. And I want to see that ending, and if I don't get to see that ending, I want to see how the player will then take this opportunity and do something different with it. You know, I want to see how this vision in my mind for this one, just even this one small detail, turns out. And I've been hanging on to that since this campaign started. And what has made it worse when you're talking about Gnarl, for me, what also kind of causes me some problems is that there are so many like little details that I'll throw into my campaign world that deal with other areas of the world where things will just come at the characters that have it. You know, they're red herrings, basically, but it's also just added detail to the background picture. Those things will trigger stuff in my mind thinking, reminding me, I want to explore this area. I'd like to run a campaign in this area about this particular thread. Even this sidetrack adventure that we did this past Sunday, in the back of my mind, what ended up happening this adventure, I was working that already as a plot thread for another campaign with these same guys once this one was done. And knowing, even though that I probably should take a break from the GM seat after this is done and we need to do something else, but I was still thinking, I can go and I can do this. And I was already working out details in my mind, how this is all going to work, what part of the world this is going to take place in. And so, yeah, I mean, when it comes to that whole long view thing, I am like lockstep in there with you.
You know what else kind of helps is I've got this picture of Gnarl from Amanda Morgan, who, by the way, needs to have more confidence in her art. But every so often I grab that picture because it sits right next to where we record. I still, I'm like, God damn, I miss you, you stupid mutt. referring to Gnarl, not Amanda. just to be clear there, in case anyone was not clear. All right, so I want to talk about one other thing. This episode may be a little bit shorter than our normal episodes, but that's because we actually have a second recording because we have an interview on Thursday, and we've got a huge roundtable coming up. We got a bunch of crap, so I need to kind of budget my time here. But there is one other thing that I wanted to hit on this episode on the topic of resurrecting ideas, and that has to do with resurrecting campaign ideas. We were having a conversation during dinner about inspiration and story ideas. We're actually talking about prose at the time, But one of the things that I brought up is something that came out of a conversation I had with Johnny G a while back. And I don't know what his source is on this, so don't ask me. But I do know Johnny G is the sort of guy that doesn't just randomly quote stuff. He tends to have a pretty solid basis for the kinds of things he says. But he said that there's apparently been some study or observation or whatever that the majority of people that come up with creative ideas do so during about a 10 or 15 year span of their life, usually about 15 to 25, maybe 15 to 30. And even if a work is not realized until much later in their life, usually the seeds of that idea, the kind of loose framework of it, goes back to that stretch when you're give or take several years around 20 years old. And that led into a conversation about gaming, where we've talked in the past about people who say, well, I'm sick of making characters, I'm out of character ideas, whatever. And our advice has often been, look, dust off some old concepts. You can probably find a great character that wasn't fully developed, or maybe was, but you had a lot of fun playing him or her. This is from a campaign years ago. Nobody you're playing with has ever even seen this character before. Pull it out, recycle it, play it again. And in the middle of talking about all of this, somewhere we kind of wandered back into prose, and Johan made an observation that I had to chew on for a second, but I think he's absolutely right. So, Johan, do you want to give that?
And sure. And my observation is simply that whether we're talking about characters, whether we're talking about campaigns, whether we're talking about prose, most stories, most concepts are genre neutral, which means you can take the same story and drop it into whatever genre you want. So if you have this wonderful idea for a fantasy game that you just really want to run, but your players won't play fantasy and we only play cyberpunk, well, all of a sudden, you know what? The dragon that was the bad guy, now he's the CEO of a corporation. The wizard is the head of IT security, whatever. All of the concepts transport from point A to point B just fine. All you have to do is change the trappings.
Kind of the case study we used on this was the contributions that we had made to Riley's steampunk anthology. Mm-hmm. And steampunk is not a real big genre amongst the hosts.
Us, I mean, yeah.
And what we were all kind of talking about is, like, you know, with the stories we put out there, what we found was that we were able to take story ideas that were from completely different genres.
Mm-hmm.
And Johan observed that really what genre is in many cases is just the trappings of the story. Spaceships became airships.
Right.
Robots and artificial intelligences became clockwork soldiers.
Right.
And these concepts still carried over, and the basic story themes could still be told. Now, I recognize with a role-playing game, it's a little bit different than prose, because when you talk about a game, you're not just talking about a genre necessarily. You might also be talking about a setting that has specific rules and boundaries.
Sure.
You might be talking about a system that does or does not capture things very well. But while I think it would require some extra work, and I also can see that this is not going to be true of every story, I agree with Johan in that I would wager 90-some-odd% of stories that you have told as a game master can be repurposed and retold either for a new group or even in a different genre setting game system.
Especially if that genre that you're going to is steampunk, because all you got to do is glue some gears on and make your flying craft inflatable. Ta-da. And you're done. Now you're steampunk.
From a pro standpoint, I've never done this because usually for me, it's easier for me to just come up with a new story than go through all of the characters in the original and try to pick out, okay, what about this was setting specific that I pull away? What changes in this setting? For games, I guess I have a hard time figuring how I would do it, because when I approach what is my overall plot, it's always tied to the players and the characters. So I would have a hard time taking that plot, mm-hmm. stripping it down to its bare essential, and then making it meaningful
Certainly.
To a different group of characters.
I think you're wrong, Wayne. Sorry.
Actually, Wayne, I'm going to agree with Johan on this. I understand where you're going.
Yeah, but, yeah,
But ultimately, I think that, yeah, you're wrong, because, you know, I mean, if you want to look at it just like from the aspect of the whole hero's journey kind of thing, each one of your characters, if you're running something in a certain way, has their own journey. And then the whole In a Certain Way is your adaptation of that. But yet at the same time, it's still a journey from this beginning point where they started to this end point, to this resolution, whatever their ultimate goal may be.
And not only that, but, you know, when you talk about how you're trying to tune a story to the players and characters, you're talking about specifics at that point. You're talking about, Cedric the Barbarian is in search of his long-lost great aunt, so I'm going to put that in there. Well, really, you strip away long-lost great aunt, what you have is familial conflict, missing person. You can take that concept and you can apply it anywhere, and it's equally effective.
I think I see what Wayne is saying, and this is going to be especially true depending on how exactly you construct your games. If you construct your games from the characters up, and you do so almost wholly, where you take a look at the character sheets and the group template, and then from that derive a plot.
And that's how I typically plan my campaign.
I would certainly say that I think it is going to be harder. And certainly, I do want to stress that you cannot expect the same result. Even if you have the same starting concepts, it is foolhardy to expect that this group is going to basically pantomime the prior group, and you're going to have the same scenes and the same moments and the same climaxes and the same anticlimaxes. That's nonsense.
It just seems like it'd be more effort than to just go through that process again.
Well, with what the you new can, characters. What I think you can do, Wayne, is if you're the sort of person who builds from ground up with your plots, don't keep large conceptual chunks of previous plots and try to reuse those. Make it more modular. Take small chunks. One thing that I used to do periodically when I was DMing was I would have all sorts of plot hooks and concepts written down on index cards. And you can run a game off of an index card. If push comes to shove, you go, I don't know what's in that cave. Crap. Reach for a card. Oh, here's an idea. Run with it. And you can do that sort of same modular concept with almost everything that you're talking about using for those custom crafted games. You just do it in smaller bites than you would with a huge overarching plot like Dan might be doing in a game he's designing.
And certainly it is going to take a little more work because you're going to have to retool some things for the characters, for the setting, for the system.
Yeah, if my NPC is set to push someone's buttons, I need to change things about that personality to push the new character's
buttons. Let me give you an example, actually, based on the most recent episode. You have, at least as far as I understand it, and don't spoil the plot for your players, so just nod and pretend what I'm saying is correct. Probably is, because it's freaking Fear the Boot. But it sounded like there are these demons that are manipulating the situation because they thrive on conflict and bloodshed and chaos, and they are using a particular arch rival of best character to do that. Well, this is a concept that works in almost anything. You know, you can take this over to pure fantasy, out of urban fantasy to pure fantasy, and you can have demons who do the exact same thing. You can take this forward to sci-fi, and you can have a race of telepaths. I mean, there's an episode of Star Trek like this, who thrive on those kinds of emotions and are trying to create conflict to open a power vacuum or to...
Even if you're doing a sci-fi that doesn't have any sort of quote-unquote magical concepts like telepathy, you can take exactly the same concept, and instead of a race of demons, you have an arms manufacturer who strives on creating conflict.
Yeah.
So they want to create chaos so that they can sell more guns. And
I think I'm finally getting this. So basically, if I take that situation in particular that we're referring to, what I would boil that down to is you've got your real bad guys who have positioned somebody that is the exact opposite of one of your characters.
Yes.
You have made them hate that character, and they are using that person then...
Yes,
as a stalking gun.
Yeah, and the myopathy.
And that could then be put in any type of setting or campaign.
Absolutely.
And the myopathy of the group to be so focused on the immediate emotional antagonism of that character pulls them away from the
what's really going on.
And will do so in any RPG group that has ever
exactly.
existed.
Exactly. And I'm not suggesting you do this for your next campaign, but what I'm suggesting here is when you talk to a game master who says, look, I've been GMing for 20 years, I'm out of plot ideas, I think there is this wonderful potential to take the essence of campaigns and certainly, once again, rejigger these a little bit to fit with the new group of characters, to fit the new specifics. But I think there's a lot of essence that you can still take away and transplant somewhere else and at least kind of go for those same basic themes and concepts.
This is really eye-opening for me. It may just be because I haven't done nearly as much GMing. I'm still much newer to GMing, so I haven't run into it yet. But the idea of looking back and actually trying to distill that essence, I've never even thought about that.
And that's really something that you can apply in any sort of creative endeavor, be it campaign design, be it prose writing, be it painting. A real common saying among artsy people is, if you see something you like that somebody else did, you take it, you break it, you make it your own. You distill it down to its essence, you find out what it was about that you liked, yeah, and then you steal it, and you make your own version of it.
And here's kind of the punchline of this. What we're suggesting is steal from yourself.
Yeah, which is the mark of, I think, maturity in a creative endeavor. You know, once you've been a successful author, say, you can stop stealing from other authors and start stealing from your own stuff.
Well, and it works really well in role-playing games because of the fact that you're a book author with a following, that same following's with you from book to book to book. But with a role-playing game, you know, it's the nature of most groups that they evolve over time. There's a very good chance that next year you'll be with the same group, but 5 years, 10 years from now, members are going to have come and gone.
Yes.
The group may have changed over completely, and you're suddenly dealing with a completely different audience who has never experienced these things before, or someone like Chad who doesn't remember lunch, much less the game you ran 2 years ago.
Just as a side note to this whole thing, I actually did that with a public work that I wrote for FASA, and I did that with that explicit goal of taking a kind of a genre-specific story and adapting that to the sci-fi genre of Battletech. I did that with the Royalty and Rogues adventure, which is nothing but a Rescue the Princess adventure. But I wanted to do that in that setting, just for that explicit purpose of doing that, adapting that very stereotypical thing that is usually attached to fantasy.
Yeah. Actually, Chris, you did that with something else, which I'm sure you will recall once I bring it
up.
I'm
sure I will. Because I sure as hell don't know what you're talking about.
In Hot Spots, do you remember that one of the contracts you wrote was that on one particular planet, there were these giant reptiles that were desired as pets by nobility because of the fact that they somewhat resembled dragons. They weren't magical or anything. They were just regular creatures.
Yes.
But because of the resemblance to dragons, and there was a contract you could take your mechs out and to try and basically incapacitate these creatures and bring them back, but they were large enough and powerful enough because they're freaking dragons that they were actually a threat to your battle mechs.
I was really hoping you were going to tell me that you had to capture them in a little red and white ball.
I was thinking the same
thing. Well, actually, yeah, that's why I'm Johnny. I
choose you, Marauder, too.
I didn't want to bring this up, actually, but
it's a failure. Should have chosen a locust.
Marauder 2 uses ERPPC. It's super effective.
I'm hiring John Grana to help me sue the people behind Pacific Rim because, you know, I had that idea years ago.
All right, well, I think we're going to go ahead and end this one here. Just like I said, I need kind of an easy edit because we got a whole load of stuff coming up. We got an interview. We got a big old ass round table, a regular episode or two in there. And on top of that, we got a contest coming up. I guarantee this one's going to be a whole lot easier than the postcard one. I got some game codes from Tex for some Xbox Live Arcade stuff.
We need a 20,000 word piece of creative fiction.
That's right. And we will take roughly a year and a half to evaluate it.
Can I take their pictures?
Actually, no, we got a really good idea. I don't totally know the details, but Pat has something with a cursed duck he wants people to tell him about. I don't know the details. So we'll find out about that whenever Pat's on the show next. Anyway, you guys have a great week, great games. I got plenty of stuff to keep myself entertained in the meantime, and we will catch you next time.
Never pick up a duck in a dungeon.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2013. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.